welcome to Religion in the News. This is Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next 30 minutes, we'll be featuring articles from the Washington Post, from the Atlantic, from the Associated Press, and more. This program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired, and don't forget that you can get podcast editions of this and all Religion in the News episodes on our website. Visit ncreadingservice.org and click on podcasts to find Religion in the News and take it with you wherever you go. Let's begin this week on Religion in the News with an article from the September 23rd edition of the Washington Post. And this article is entitled, Blessed is God, the True Judge, Ginsburg Memorialized in Hebrew in the Halls of the Supreme Court. This is by Julie Zosmer of the Washington Post. As 3 days of ceremonial mourning began on Wednesday for Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the first woman to receive the honor of lying in state at the U.S. Capitol, Hebrew words resounded in the marble hall of the highest court in the land. The first words of the ceremony came from Jewish tradition, yet spoke specifically to Ginsburg's life's work. Baruch Dayan HaEmet, Rabbi Lauren Holtzblatt began the memorial service, Blessed is God, the True Judge. Ginsburg brought her Judaism into her chambers, where she hung the biblical words Tzedek, Tzedek, Tirdof, which mean justice, justice shall you pursue. On Wednesday, she was remembered in a ceremony for her family and her fellow Supreme Court justices as both an American luminary and a Jewish one. To be born into a world that does not see you, that does not believe in your potential, and despite this, to be able to see beyond the world you're in, to imagine that something can be different, that is the job of a prophet. And it is the rare prophet who not only imagines a new world, but also makes that world a reality in her lifetime, Holtzblatt said, speaking of Ginsburg's lifelong work to enshrine gender equality in the nation's laws. Holtzblatt, the rabbi who led the ceremony along with Chief Justice John G. Roberts, Jr., has personal ties to Ginsburg beyond leading Northwest Washington's Adas Israel Synagogue, where Ginsburg worshipped. Holtzblatt's husband, a lawyer, clerked for Ginsburg. Last Friday, Holtzblatt learned of Ginsburg's death just as the Jewish holiday of Rosh Hashanah began at sundown. She shared the news with her congregation during her live-streamed worship service, closing her eyes with emotion as she recalled taking her two young children to see Ginsburg's chambers when her husband was a clerk. As Holtzblatt's curious young daughter touched the photographs and memorabilia around the room, Ginsburg took the girl by the hand and shared with her what each object meant. She was kind, she was loving, she was deeply caring, Holtzblatt said, recalling that when she and her husband attended a ceremony where Ginsburg's Supreme Court portrait was unveiled, Ginsburg mentioned that she could not have served her country every day without her housekeeper's help. The rabbi and the justice co-wrote an essay in 2015 about the often overlooked women of the Exodus story, which many families now read at their Passover Seders. When she spoke on Wednesday about Ginsburg's role in creating professional opportunities for women across America, Holtzblatt briefly touched on her own role. As co-senior rabbi of the 1700 family synagogue Adas Israel, Holtzblatt is one of only a small group of women to serve as head rabbis of large synagogues in the conservative Jewish denomination, which has ordained women as rabbis since 1985. For Ginsburg to lie in repose at the Supreme Court on Wednesday and Thursday, then lie in state at the Capitol on Friday, her family chose to forego the Jewish custom of a speedy burial, generally within 3 days of death. Instead, they chose a memorial that infused Judaism into America's rituals of mourning. Ginsburg's rabbi chanted, El Malei Rachamim, God full of mercy, and the 23rd Psalm, as the Supreme Court justices bowed their heads, the words echoing off the columns, and washing over the flag-draped casket. We'll turn next to an article from September 29th published at The Atlantic, and the headline on this article, Trump secretly mocks his Christian supporters. The subheadline, former aides say that in private, the president has spoken with cynicism and contempt about believers. And this is by McKay Coppins of The Atlantic. One day in 2015, Donald Trump beckoned Michael Cohen, his longtime confidant and personal attorney, into his office. Trump was brandishing a printout of an article about an Atlanta-based megachurch pastor trying to raise $60 million from his flock to buy a private jet. Trump knew the preacher personally. Creflo Dollar had been among a group of evangelical figures who visited him in 2011 while he was first exploring a presidential bid. Trump had reverently bowed his head in prayer during the meeting while the pastors laid hands on him. Now he was gleefully reciting the impious details of Dollar's quest for a Gulfstream G650. Trump seemed delighted by the scam, Cohen recalled to me, and eager to highlight that the pastor was, quote, full of shit. They're all hustlers, Trump said. The president's alliance with religious conservatives has long been premised on the contention that he takes them seriously, while Democrats hold them in disdain. In speeches and interviews, Trump routinely lavishes praise on conservative Christians, casting himself as their champion. My administration will never stop fighting for Americans of faith, he declared at a rally for evangelicals earlier this year. It's a message his campaign will seek to amplify in the coming weeks as Republicans work to confirm Amy Coney Barrett, a devout conservative Catholic, to the Supreme Court. But in private, many of Trump's comments about religion are marked by cynicism and contempt, according to people who have worked for him. Former aides told me they've heard Trump ridicule conservative religious leaders, dismiss various faith groups with cartoonish stereotypes, and deride certain rites and doctrines held sacred by many of the Americans who constitute his base. Reach for comment, a White House spokesman said that people of faith know that President Trump is a champion for religious liberty and the sanctity of life, and he has taken strong actions to support them and protect their freedom to worship. The president is also well known for joking and his terrific sense of humor, which he shares with people of all faiths. From the outset of his brief political career, Trump has viewed white right-wing evangelical leaders as a kind of special interest group to be schmoozed, conned, or bought off, former aides told me. Though he faced Republican primary opponents in 2016 with deeper religious roots, Ted Cruz and Mike Huckabee, Trump was confident that his wealth and celebrity would attract high-profile Christian surrogates to vouch for him. His view was, I've been talking to these people for years. I've let them stay at my hotels. They're going to endorse me. I played the game, said a former campaign advisor to Trump, who, like others quoted in the story, spoke on the condition of anonymity to describe private conversations. It helped that Trump seemed to feel a kinship with prosperity preachers, often evincing a game-recognizes-game approach appreciation for their hustle. The former campaign advisor recalled showing his boss a YouTube video of the Israeli televangelist Benny Hinn performing some faith healings, while Trump laughed at the spectacle and muttered, "Man, that's some racket." On another occasion, the advisor told me, Trump expressed awe at Joel Osteen's media empire, particularly the viewership of his televised sermons. In Cohen's recent memoir, Disloyal, he recounts Trump returning from his 2011 meeting with the pastors who laid hands on him and sneering, quote, "Can you believe that bullshit?" But if Trump found their rituals ridiculous, he followed their money-making ventures closely. He was completely familiar with the business dealings of the leadership in many prosperity gospel churches, the advisor told me. The conservative Christian elites Trump surrounds himself with have always been more clear-eyed about his lack of religiosity than they've publicly let on. In a September 2016 meeting with about a dozen influential figures on the religious right, including the talk radio host Eric Metaxas, the Dallas megachurch pastor Robert Jeffress, and the theologian Wayne Grudem, the then-candidate was blunt about his relationship to Christianity. In a recording of the meeting obtained by The Atlantic, the candidate can be heard shrugging off his scriptural ignorance, "I don't know the Bible as well as some of the other people," and joking about his inexperience with prayer. "The first time I met Mike Pence, he said, 'Will you bow your head and pray?' And I said, 'Excuse me? I'm not used to it.'" At one point in the meeting, Trump interrupted a discussion about religious freedom to complain about Senator Ben Sasse of Nebraska and brag about the taunting nickname he'd devised for him. "I call him Little Ben Sasse," Trump said. "I have to do it. I'm sorry. That's when my religion always deserts me." And yet by the end of the meeting, much of which was spent discussing the urgency of preventing trans women from using women's restrooms, the candidate had the group eating out of his hand. "I'm not voting for Trump to be the teacher of my third-grader Sunday school class. That's not what he's running for," Jeffress said in the meeting, adding, "I believe it's imperative that we do everything we can to turn people out." The Faustian nature of the religious right's bargain with Trump has not always been quite so apparent to rank-and-file believers. According to the Pew Research Center, white evangelicals are more than twice as likely the average American to say that the president is a religious man. Some conservative pastors have described him as a baby Christian and insist that he's accepted Jesus Christ as his savior. To those who have known and worked with Trump closely, the notion that he might have a secret spiritual side is laughable. I always assumed he was an atheist, Barbara Rez, a former executive of the Trump Organization, told me. He's not a religious guy, AJ Delgado, who worked on his 2016 campaign, told me. Whenever I see a picture of him standing in a group of pastors, all of their hands on him, I see a thought bubble with the words, "What suckers?" Mary Trump, the president's niece, told me. Greg Thornberry, a former president of the Evangelical King's College, who was courted by the campaign in 2016, told me that even those who acknowledge Trump's lack of personal piety are convinced that he holds their faith in high esteem. "I don't think for a moment that they would believe he's cynical about them," Thornberry said. Trump's public appeals to Jewish voters have been similarly discordant with his private comments. Last week, the Washington Post reported that after calls with Jewish lawmakers, the president has said the Jews are only in it for themselves. And while he's quick to tout his daughter Ivanka's conversion to Judaism when he's speaking to Jewish audiences, he is sometimes less effusive in private. Cohen told me that once years ago he was with Trump when his wife Melania informed him that their son was at a playdate with a Jewish girl from his school. "Great," Trump said to Cohen, who is Jewish. "I'm going to lose another one of my kids to your people." One religious group that the Trump campaign is keenly fixated on this year is Mormons. In 2016, members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints rejected the Republican ticket in unprecedented numbers. To win them over in 2020, the campaign has made Donald Trump Jr. its envoy, sending him to campaign in Utah and other Mormon-heavy states. The president's son has cultivated relationships with high-profile conservatives in the faith. Earlier this year, he invoked Mormon pioneers in a call with reporters to describe his father's innovative spirit. In fact, according to two senior Utah Republicans with knowledge of the situation, Don Jr. has been so savvy in courting Latter-day Saints, expressing interest in the church's history and reading from the Book of Mormon, that he's left some influential Republicans in the state with the impression that he may want to convert. A spokesman for Don Jr. did not respond to a request for comment. "I've been curious about the president's opinion of Mormonism ever since I interviewed him in 2014 at Mar-a-Lago. During our conversation, Trump began to strenuously argue that Mitt Romney's exotic faith had cost him the 2012 election. When I interrupted to inform him that I'm also a Mormon, he quickly changed tack, extolling my church's many virtues and then switching subjects. He remained committed to his theory about 2012. During his September 2016 meeting with evangelical leaders, Trump repeatedly asserted that Christians didn't turn out for Romney because of the Mormon thing. I've always wondered what Trump might have said if I hadn't cut him off." When I shared the story with Cohen, he laughed. Trump, he said, frequently made fun of Romney's faith in private and was especially vicious when he learned about the religious undergarments worn by many Latter-day Saints. "Oh my God," Cohen said. "How many times did he bring up Mitt Romney and the undergarments?" We'll move next to an article from the Associated Press dated September 30th. And this article is entitled, "As Virus Curbs Nepal's Festivals, Devotees Fear God's Anger." This is by Binaj Guru Bacharia, and Dateline Kathmandu, Nepal. The revered living goddess is not leaving her temple this year. The old palace courtyard, packed with hundreds of thousands of people each year during the Indrajatra festival, is deserted. The temples are locked, and all public celebrations are banned by the government to curb the coronavirus. Autumn is the festival season in predominantly Hindu Nepal, where religion, celebrations, and rituals are big parts of lives, but people this year will have to scale down their rituals within their homes. Many in this Himalayan nation believe they would anger the gods by shunning the rituals, which would cause catastrophe. Even violent clashes broke out between police and devotees defying government orders during a separate chariot festival south of Kathmandu. A lockdown was ordered around the 8 days when the canceled Indrajatra festival would have been held, and instead, a small ceremony to seek forgiveness from Indra, the Hindu god of rain, was held under government security. During the festival, Kumari, a girl revered as the living goddess, is taken around the core part of Kathmandu in a chariot pulled by devotees. After the cancellation, she never left her temple palace. Her chariot is locked in the shed, and armed police guard the courtyards. There would be hundreds of thousands of devotees crowding the courtyard and streets during the festival, which would have put so many of them at the risk of getting the coronavirus, said Kumari's chief caretaker, Gautam Shakya. "We had to stop the centuries-old festival for the first time ever." Shakya and his family have been taking care of Kumari for generations. A young, flawless girl is chosen from a single clan and is worshipped as the living goddess until she is replaced at puberty. High officials and commoners touch her feet to get her blessing. A small group of devotees who slipped through the lockdown and security to pray before the living goddess said they needed to continue the tradition followed by their ancestors. The festival in Kumari is not just a tradition. It is our culture and a big part of our lives, which we just cannot stop for anything, not even for a pandemic, said Shankar Magaya, a launderer who was able to offer flowers and sweets to the goddess. Magaya felt heartbroken by the cancellation, saying while they understand the government order, they needed to protect their religion, culture, and tradition. We have disappointed the gods, and we need to keep the gods happy so we can all be happy and prosper, he said. Nepalese authorities imposed a strict coronavirus lockdown in March that was eased in July. More than 76,000 people have been infected and 491 have died. But the ban of outdoor festivals and religious gatherings continues, and temples remain locked. Near Kumari's temple, a huge statue of Hindu deity Swet Bhairav is open to the public only once a year during the festival. Devotees push each other to get a sip of the rice wine that is released from a pipe attached to the head of the statue. This year, the doors were only cracked open, and a very few people were lucky enough to sip the holy wine. Temple priest Prakash Tamarkar, who looked disappointed, said the festival should have been allowed with social distancing precautions and police blocking the courtyard. My family has done this for generations, and not once have I heard it was canceled, the priest said. These festivals are done so that we pray to the gods to spare the people of all troubles and protect us, all of us, from diseases and catastrophes. Just south of Kathmandu in Lalitpur City, a five-story high chariot holding a statue of the deity Rato Machindranath was built for a festival that was parked by government orders. Frustrated devotees revolted and thousands gathered to pull the chariot earlier this month. They clashed with riot police who fired tear gas and water and beat some with bamboo batons. Several people were wounded and many arrested. Nepal's biggest and most celebrated Dasain festival in October is celebrated for 2 weeks with public holidays. People travel to see extended family, celebrate daily feasts, and visit temples. However, scaled-down activities with some prohibitions are expected this year. We are not celebrating the festivals this year because of the virus, and we have no extra money to spend. But if we are alive and healthy, there will be festivals next year and the year after that, and we will have a grand celebration, said Kumar Shrestha, a sweet shop owner. Next up on Religion in the News, an article from September 30th, published on Religion News Service. This article entitled, Complaints on Trump's Debate Performance Highlight Generational Divide Among White Evangelicals. And this is by Jack Jenkins of Religion News Service. Kyle Mayard Schapp didn't even make it to the climate change section of the first presidential debate between President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden. Despite running Young Evangelicals for Climate Action, an environmental advocacy group, Mayard Schapp only managed to watch about 30 minutes before he picked up his remote and turned off the program in disgust. It wasn't so much a debate as a shouting match with no structure, he said. He decided to switch over and watch the television show Black-ish instead. It seemed clearer than ever that Trump doesn't have any respect for American voters, Mayard Schapp, age 31, said, adding that he felt disrespected as an evangelical by what he sees as Trump's clearly transactional relationship with the religious voting bloc. To be fair, Mayard Schapp was one of many viewers, of all religious stripes and none, who found themselves exasperated by the first public sparring session between the presidential candidates on Tuesday evening, September 29th. The encounter was widely panned as chaotic, with the president frequently talking over his opponent and both candidates trading barbs tinged with barely contained contempt. But while the debate may have alienated many viewers, evidence quickly mounted that Trump's bombastic performance, as well as his response to questions about white supremacy, didn't sit well with a group whose tenuous ties with the GOP have been further fractured by his presidency, younger white evangelicals. An early hint of that frustration emerged roughly an hour into the debate when the Twitter account of Hillsong Church, a global evangelical community that caters to younger worshipers, tweeted out a message that read, "Can't they just mute Trump's microphone? He is coming across as such a bully. No respect for him. Sorry." The account also liked many tweets critical of Trump's debate performance. Hillsong, headquartered in Australia, later apologized for the tweet, which was promptly deleted, explaining the message was published accidentally by a staffer who thought they were tweeting from their personal account. Hillsong does not comment on partisan politics, read the church's statement. But despite the apology, many celebrated the initial tweet and the accidental tweeter on social media. Others were quick to express shock regarding Trump's response when he was asked to condemn white supremacy during the debate. The president initially said, sure, but when pushed by Biden to condemn the Proud Boys, a group known for sharing white nationalist memes and that marched alongside extremist groups during the 2017 Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, Trump said the group should stand back and stand by. The president of the United States could not clearly condemn white supremacy, tweeted Melissa Moore, the daughter of popular Bible teacher Beth Moore. Slightly older evangelicals were also concerned by Trump's remarks. J.D. Greer, pastor of the Summit Church in North Carolina and president of the Southern Baptist Convention, tweeted out a thinly veiled reference to the president's remarks on Wednesday afternoon. When asked to condemn white supremacy, every single one of us should be ready to do so, tweeted Greer, age 47. Racism is sadly not extinct, and we know from our Southern Baptist history the effects of the horrific sins of racism and hatred. The reactions of Myard Schaap and other young evangelicals did not surprise Daniel Cox, a research fellow for polling and public opinion at the American Enterprise Institute. He said many younger evangelicals exhibit a less combative politics than their parents. They've come of age in a multicultural, multiracial environment, Cox said. That creates a very different approach to politics when you have these close connections to people who are very different from you. When you ask how many folks have friends or family members who are gay or lesbian or of different religions or races, younger evangelicals are just far more likely to have those relationships. Cox pointed to data highlighting this generational shift within white evangelicalism toward politics in general and Trump in particular. In a 2019 voter study group survey, 80% of white evangelicals over age 45 expressed a very favorable or somewhat favorable view of Trump. But when surveyors asked white evangelicals age 18 to 44 the same question, only 61% said the same. Cox was quick to note these trends predate Trump and have already appeared in the world of electoral politics. Two prominent Democratic faith outreach experts are younger white evangelicals, Joshua Dixon, who heads up Biden's faith outreach team, and Michael Ware, who did the same for Barack Obama's 2012 reelection campaign. Ware argued that while many young evangelicals may retain support for Trump, Tuesday night's debate likely made it more difficult for them to justify their choice to non-evangelical friends. They were looking last night for a Donald Trump that they could defend to their peers, he said. If that Donald Trump exists at all, he sure didn't show up last night. The president's perceived lack of Christian kindness is already hurting him with faithful Americans in general. According to a recent survey of religious voters, including Catholics and evangelicals, conducted by a slate of academics and paid for by the liberal advocacy group The Common Good, the perception that Trump lacks basic Christian kindness is the strongest driver of defecting from Trump in 2020. The perspective appeared to inform Shauna Nyquist, the daughter of former megachurch pastor Bill Hybels, who voiced her frustrations with Trump's debate antics on Wednesday. Last night we saw one individual who looked into the camera and addressed American families with empathy and dignity, she wrote in a Facebook post, referring to the debate. And we saw one individual who bullied and lied over and over and over. I know that a debate isn't everything, but last night revealed so much. The post was accompanied by a white image emblazoned with a sentence that read, I watched the debate tonight, and at a certain point my rage turned into tears. There are matters where younger and older evangelicals still have much in common. Cox said younger evangelicals don't differ much from their parents on issues of race, a trait he said tracks with younger white Americans as a whole. Younger white Americans are still pretty segregated, he said. But younger evangelicals do differ from their parents in key ways. They are more supportive of immigrants, LGBTQ rights, and taking action on climate change than their older compatriots. And while Trump's brand of politics may exacerbate those trends, they are unlikely to go away even if Trump is not reelected. For his part, Myard Schaap said he did eventually go back and read accounts of Trump's response when he was pressed on whether the climate was changing due to human activity. He hedged on the very existence of the problem at all, Myard Schaap said. Trump's insistence that he doesn't think he needs to get serious with climate change is a perfect distillation of how far apart he and younger evangelical voters are on the issue. Young evangelicals are tired of the kind of politics that tells them they either need to check their faith or their brain at the door. We'll return to the Associated Press for our final story this week on religion in the news. And this is entitled Orthodox Church Petitions UN Over Istanbul's Hagia Sophia, Dateline Ankara, Turkey, from September 29th. The Greek Orthodox Church of the United States said Tuesday it is petitioning United Nations experts to coerce Turkey into protecting Orthodox Christianity's cultural heritage following the Turkish government's conversion of Istanbul's landmark Hagia Sophia from a museum into a mosque. The Greek Orthodox Archdiocese of America said it was pressing UN special rapporteurs in the areas of cultural rights, minority rights, freedom of religion and beliefs to hold Turkey accountable for its deliberate policies to erase the cultural heritage of Orthodox Christians. In a move that drew praise from the Muslim faithful and widespread international opposition, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan issued a decree in July that turned Hagia Sophia back into a Muslim house of prayer. The structure, a UNESCO World Heritage Site, has served as one of Christendom's most important cathedrals and a mosque for centuries, as well as a museum for 86 years. Erdogan announced a decision last month to transform the Church of the Holy Savior in Kora, another Byzantine-era church in Istanbul, into a mosque as well. By unilaterally changing the status, structure, and name of these UNESCO sites with particular significance to Orthodox Christians, Turkey is in violation of its obligations under international law to preserve cultural heritage and to respect the political, cultural, and religious freedoms of Orthodox Christians in Turkey and abroad, Archdiocese of America Counsel Christina Hiorias told the Associated Press in an emailed statement. The Greek Orthodox Archdiocese hopes that international pressure from the United Nations, its bodies, including UNESCO, and its member states will motivate Turkey to reverse its decision to convert the World Heritage Sites into mosques. There is no immediate comment from the Turkish government, which has vowed to protect Hagia Sophia and to keep it open to visitors outside of prayer hours. Built by the Byzantine Emperor Justinian in 537, Hagia Sophia was turned into a mosque with the 1453 Ottoman conquest of Istanbul. Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, the founding leader of the secular Turkish Republic, converted the structure into a museum in 1934. Erdogan, a pious Muslim whose ruling party has roots in Turkey's Islamic movement, reconverted the building into a mosque, despite calls for it to be kept as a museum in recognition of Istanbul's multi-faith heritage. The move was largely seen as being geared toward consolidating the ruling party's conservative and religious support base at a time when its popularity is sagging amid an economic downturn. The Hagia Sophia was built 1,500 years ago to be the cathedral and first church of the Ecumenical Patriarchate, Greek Orthodox Archbishop Elpidophoros of America said. Today, with a heavy heart, we behold the historic and indeed essential Greek Orthodox Christian cultural heritage of Turkey being misappropriated with the conversion of Hagia Sophia into a mosque, he told the AP. To do so is to start down a path toward denial of history, a path that denies the future as well. We've reached the end of our time for this week on Religion in the News. We certainly thank you for tuning in and hope you've enjoyed the program. I'm Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Don't forget that you can get podcasts of our programs available on our website. Just visit ncreadingservice.org and click Listen, then find Religion in the News under the podcast list. We hope you enjoy the program, and we'll talk to you next time on Religion in the News.